that distance, you could triple it, and that's how much length I have. It's about 200 feet. I hope I answered the questions properly.
Yeah, I'd load up this fire escape.
Yeah, that's a possibility. By the way, when you talk about crossing the wire, I have been on a number of occasions put wire in crazy places, not by putting the wire there, by putting fishing string. I mean, with a monofilament line on a fly casting fishing reel and a weight on the end of it, you can make the piece of string go all kinds of crazy places, on top of another building, on top of a tree, and so on. And then the string pulls a piece of cord, the cord pulls a piece of rope, the rope pulls the wire. It's a multi-step process. So you don't have to throw the wire directly. So you might have supports out there that are possible. Also, had you said that 20 meters is one of your bands, there's a number of guys who from the balcony of their apartment strung a very simple helical wound whip-like antenna on 20 meters, which was electronically a half wavelength long, and they fed the bottom end of it using the railing of the balcony as the counterpoise, and that worked like a charm. So feeding the end of a wire or the end of something that resonates works like a charm. Now, when you're down to numbers like 60 meters, 80 meters, and 160 meters, a helical wound self-supporting structure is essentially out of the question. There are various kinds of isotron and other kinds of fancy loop-like antennas with built-in resonators that are super compact and work very well. Let me drop it. But I'll warn you, whenever you physically take the real estate of an antenna, like a good 80-meter half-wave dipole, should be 132 feet long, and now you wind it up into some kind of a loop-like structure, or do whatever so that it's only 10 feet in any one dimension, so to speak, by definition, it's going to be very high in Q. In other words, every time you change frequency by 20 kc, you've got to retune the antenna. And that's a livable situation. So there are various kinds of loop-like resonators. Isotron is one of the brand names I do remember at one time. And if you do a search, you'll find others. And they work rather well. The fact that the antenna is physically small doesn't mean it's low in performance. That 80-meter dipole example that I've used so often, let me drop it. Where the 80-meter dipole to be half wave and full length is supposed to be 132 feet of 14-gauge wire, so to speak. And you make it only 30 feet long instead of 132 feet long. And you put the right kind of a tuning assembly, an inductor and a capacitor, at the feed point. And or use a very broad range antenna tuner so that you force the antenna into resonance. That super small compact antenna I just described, if you compared its gain and its performance compared to the full size, as long as you've used the right materials that don't have electronic loss to them, you never lose more than 0.4 dB. The infinitesimal dipole with high performance inductors and capacitors never loses more than 0.4 dB in gain or effective capture area or anything else you want to measure compared to the full-length half-wave dipole. You say that to the majority of ham radio operators and they'll say, what in the world are you smoking? You're crazy. You look at the appropriate chapter of the Bible of antenna books, the book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, by John Krause, W-H-A-K. Head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio University for a whole lot of years. Let me drop. You look at his chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, and you'll find out he is saying that way back in 1950. A lot of guys have actually done this. So a piece of wire hanging out the window, as long as it's not scraping against things and swinging in the wind, I think there's ways you can, with fishing string, get a slope around there. But so your choices, as I see it, are some of these compact loop-like things that resonate, or a piece of wire with the right kind of tuning assembly. The fact that you're in-feeding a piece of wire, in-fed ZEP as it's called, Zeppelin, an airship used to use these kind of antennas, can work like a charm. There probably are ways you can fire up the fire escape itself. I'm a little worried about that because it, by definition, is going to have a lot of rusty bolt connections in between the various floors. There are guys who have... Let me drop. I remember Norm, K2YEW, one of the prominent members of this club 20 years ago. He became a silent key 8 or so years ago. He used to operate on, I think it was 40 meters, by resonating the metal of his storm window on his apartment. And so as long as you can force whatever chunk of metal you've got to go into resonance by putting the right inductor and capacitor on your piece of metal, you can force anything into resonance. Once you force it into resonance, you will get the infinitesimal dipole performance, never lower than 0.4 dB from a full-length half-wave dipole. With that philosophy, law enforcement vehicles have used the side view mirror as an antenna, the rear speaker assembly as an antenna, and so on. You can put the gap in the sheet metal between the fender and the body of the car can become an antenna, and you paint it over with fiberglass so no one even knows there's a gap there. So any chunk of metal can be forced into resonance. That's the main thing you're looking for. It's going to take some experimentation. Also, it's going to take a little bit of research. I'm guessing there are a number of articles you can go to that'll help you put in a stealthy antenna in an apartment environment. Because your request is for 80 meters and 160 meters, you're a top bander, as they say, the longest wavelength. You've added a little bit of an extra challenge to it, but don't let that discourage you. It can be done. Let's see if we have other people on frequency who have got a suggestion for Joe's antenna from a fourth floor apartment building. He wants to hang something out the window so he can get on 160 meters and 80 meters, for instance. K2RIW and TechNet, we're listening.
Union JK to UPS Mobile, I got the info for him.
Yeah, I have visited Rich's installation on one occasion, where he's a guy who, from his mobile, operates on these super low frequencies, big antenna requirement, and yet with small portable antennas, he's done it. I'd also like to know, you're on the road right now, most likely somewhere between New Jersey and Illinois. You're probably seeing the leading edge of this 30 inches of snow that's heading for us, Rich. So give us any information on all of the above. K2UPS, mobile, somewhere on the east coast of the United States. K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and the rest of the net. I've been in the snow for the last couple of hours, and I just crossed from West Virginia into Pennsylvania. I'm on I-70, right where I-70 and I-79 split off, and it's not pleasant out here. But as far as the information that Joe's looking for, Joe, I just emailed you a link to an article. There's a lot of good information in there about NFED and random length wires. There's a chart at the end of that article that is colored. It's like a colored bar graph. What you do at the top is you pick the band you want to operate on, and then you go. Then it gives you a color to follow. You follow that color down, and you pick a spot on the graph that is not colored in, that is still white. And that would be the recommended. You could use any one of those that is not colored that would recommend that it should load up. Now you want 60, 80, and 160. And unfortunately, with the way that those are harmonically related, you can get 80 and 160. The shortest wire being between like 130, 135 feet, you're not going to be too happy with 60 meters on that. So you might need a second antenna. But check your inbox, look at that article, and when I stop next, I'll forward you some more information as well. Dick, back to that.
I can tell someone else is trying to sign in. We're going to get to you in a minute. Fantastic, Rich. Boy, you're sending him information already. You're doing all that while rolling through a snowstorm in the area of West Virginia to Pennsylvania. Wow. Hey, Joe, you're getting your money's worth tonight. And, hey, Rich, we owe you one for all this. Well done. And he's going through the snowstorm that's heading for us, so... You can put your signature on those snowflakes. So we're going to be seeing them pretty soon, Rich, as I see it. Who was the other person who wanted to sign in with some information? Give me your full call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW.
Very quick and nice. Was there another person? Yeah, it was so brief that I only heard a fraction of a syllable. Didn't recognize it was you this time. You got it, Eric.
No, I'm just going to make a suggestion as far as 80 meters and 60. You could go and buy yourself a Hustler mobile coil.
Yeah.
Make a little mount on your window still. It's pretty effective. If you want to go down to 160, you're going to have to make your own hat boot because they don't make coils that big. But if you do like to spend money and you want something that will go down to 160, I think it's Tar Heel makes one. It's motorized, looks like a tube, gets longer and taller. I have one on the back of my car. But that'll take you from 160 all the way up to 1080. Have to make a bit of a mount if it's in the window that you can, you know, put in and take out, but it's a doable thing. Get your IWC.
Some more good suggestions, and I thank you, Eric. The main thing you're looking for here, Joe, the magic that we ham radio operators have discovered a long time ago, and the better antenna engineers have discovered a long time ago, the magic seven words: resonate first, then you can radiate. No matter what your piece of wire or your hunk of metal or whatever is, if you can force it into electronic resonance, it will radiate like a charm. It'll give you full performance. It's the magic of resonance. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that. So whatever antenna you set up, if you decide to homebrew, and by way of somebody's antenna analyzer, you find out what is the real impedance of that antenna. And then you go to the Berkeley program. You Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance match. You put those two words together as a Google search, you'll find the Berkeley program. Once you know the impedance of your antenna, and you tell it to the Berkeley program, and you tell it what frequency you're at, and you press go, the Berkeley program will give you 16 solutions. An L network, a pi network, a T network, an L pi network, and so on. They give you the values of the inductor and the capacitor, and you can wind your own inductor, you can build your own capacitor if you want to. So, by various means, you can take the real impedance of your antenna, whatever it happens to be, and force it into resonance with the Berkeley program. Once your antenna resonates, it will radiate. So whether it be the iron railing on the fire escape, whether it be the window, whether it be a hunk of wire you hang out the window, whether it be a loop of wire you set up, whether it be any of these other antennas, the magic is you want to force it into rest.
Repeater, timeout.
Gee, that's my first timeout tonight, and we still have the Eastern input. So, your case, Joe, is not unique. You'd be amazed how many guys are in a situation like yours, and they think that their environment is too restrictive for antennas. There's all kinds of ways you can put up stealthy antennas in your environment where the neighbors won't see it. In some cases, you only put it out at nighttime, but again, you're just going to force it into resonance. As you finally find the right solution with all the data that's on the way to you, Joe, come back and let us know how it goes, what you've tried, what worked, what didn't work. We'd like to hear more of your story. K2MVR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2MVR. Very good, very good. Thank you. Thank you so much, Rich. K2UPS and the other gentleman that also gave me the advice of the Tar Heel and you, Dick, definitely. Always very appreciative of all the wealth of information, and I like that. You resonate first, then you can radiate. Yeah, I'll experiment with that wire, and I'm planning to do, like you said, Dick, with a fishing line and throw it over. I mean, I'm just staring at all this empty space, at least 200 feet of trees. I know I could, I can resonate something and then radiate. Anyway, have a good evening. Thank you. Thank you so much, 73, and please be safe, everybody. Good evening, K2MBR. Thank you.
In theory, a slingshot is an illegal weapon in New York City, but there's a product where with a slingshot and it's got a fly fishing reel on it, you can shoot a weight 200 feet out over a tree, over a lamppost or whatever. So a monofilament line, pulling a string, pulling a rope, pulling your wire, there's all kinds of ways you can do it. Hams are very crafty people. And those magic words, those seven words, you resonate first, then you can radiate. In my opinion, as an antenna designer, those are the most important seven words. I know of no antenna book. I own about 35 books on the subject of antennas. Not one of them says that. I've taken a whole lot of electrical engineering courses on antennas. Not one professor has ever said that. We amateurs know that secret. The people in the antenna designing world, in the antenna design department of major corporations like Sperry and Airborne Instruments Laboratory and Hazeltine and whatever, these companies, the antenna engineering department, never discovered those words. That's amazing to me. And we amateurs have got that secret. Alrighty, I think we should go over to at least one mailbag item, John, and then I'm going to go over to the subject of the kind of portable power we should all be considering for situations like what's coming to us in the next couple of days. KC2WTB with the mail gag. K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB and a mailbag. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Yeah, we got a, should be a quick one. Gentleman who's studying third order harmonics. He has a question about that, so I'll let me let her drop and I'll explain the question. Okay, he's reading about the two-tone test and something he's discovered. He wants to know if he's correct in assuming this, that if the fundamental frequency drops by 1 dB, it automatically drops the third-order harmonics by 3 dB. Maybe you can give him an idea how that progresses, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
There's a sort of a yes and a no to that. It depends, as they say. In order to measure the linearity of an amplifier, you could do the direct brute force approach. Start off with a good signal generator, start off with the minimum power coming out of the signal generator, and step up the power one decibel at a time. That's the power going into your amplifier under test or into the microphone circuit, and you're turning up an audio amplifier that's putting in a tone. So in either case, you're increasing the input to a system, and hopefully you've got an accurate output power measuring equipment, and you measure the power output. And you'll eventually find out that at a certain power level of input, where you increase by 1 dB, the output didn't increase by 1 dB, it increased by half a dB. You're starting to hit saturation. Every amplifier in the world, whether it be audio, radio, whatever, has a limitation beyond which it goes into limiting. Let me drop. And one of the tests that is frequently done in simple amplifier testing is you find out at what power level, when you graph the horizontal axis is input power, the vertical axis is output power, and if you're rating those in decibels, then there should be a 45-degree line across that chart of input versus output power, and eventually your amplifier starts curving away from that 45-degree line as you go up to the right, and at the point where it's 1 dB away from that line, 1 dB of compression, that's one of the ways of rating of an amplifier. What is the power output at 1 dB compression? That's a medium good test, but it's not a very easy test to do, and it requires a lot of incremental accuracy of your signal generator and of your power measuring device. The two-tone test is a more severe test, but it's more, it gives you a lot more information. If I was doing a two-tone test of a single sideband system, you're going to put a pair of equal amplitude sine wave tones into the microphone circuit, so to speak. And maybe those two tones are going to be a 1 KC note and a 1.6 KC note. And if the amplifier is thoroughly linear, when you look with a spectrum analyzer at the radio output, Let's assume that your transmitter is a 100-megacycle transmitter. You're going to see one line at 100 megacycles, and you're going to see a second line higher than the first line by the separation of those two tones. In my case, I said 1 kc and 1.6 kc, so the two tones are going to be separated by 600 hertz. That's what happened at the input. That's what's going to happen at the output. So you're going to see two equal amplitude tones on that spectrum analyzer screen, looking at the output of your RF amplifier, single sideband system, and there should be nothing else there. Okay. Every real amplifier at some reasonable power level where you're likely to use it is going to be making some kind of distortion such that whatever is the separation between those two primary tones, you're going to see a bunch of other tones above and below your two tones with the exact same separation. The first set of tones on each side are called third order because it requires the second harmonic of one mixed with the fundamental of the other. That's a 2+1. It's a 3-to-1 mix, so to speak. That's one simple explanation of why it's called third order intermodulation distortion. There's a more complicated answer. We won't go there. Let me drop. And if you've got enough dynamic range on your spectrum analyzer and if you're demanding enough power output of your transmitter, you're also going to see fifth-order intermodulation distortion products, which are twice the spacing above and below. So there's a whole Christmas tree that comes out of any reasonable amplifier. Now, with the usual method of saturation of the amplifier, if the two individual tones are both lowered by 1 decibel, identical each tone of the two, then yes, the third order products will move by 3. There's a 3-to-1 relationship. And if you plotted the intermodulation distortion products on that same graph, along with the fundamentals, the third order products at various powers of input of the two tones, the third order products will have a 3-to-1 slope, whereas the fundamentals will have a 1-to-1 slope, and the fifth order products will have a 5-to-1 slope at reasonable power levels. And so it's an extremely severe test because, let me drop. You think you're putting in two tones because you've used two audio signal generators in my example, 1 kc and 1.6 kc. You think you're putting in two tones. The transmitter is, let me pick a number, 5 kilohertz wide on its microphone circuit. It doesn't know there are two tones. All it knows is you're putting in this complicated signal. And so for periods of time, those two tones, for a short period of time, are in phase with each other because one's at a higher frequency than the other. They slide out of phase. So they're sliding in phase and out of phase 600 times per second because they're 600 hertz separated. During the time they're in phase, those two tones add together at twice the input voltage, and you're demanding 4 times the output power during that instant when they're in phase. When they're out of phase, the two signals completely cancel each other if they're equal in amplitude, and so you're demanding absolute zero power output during that instant. If you now think about it, what you're doing with the two-tone test in this example is you're making the amplifier go to absolute full power output, absolute minimum power output, and you're asking it to do that 600 times per second, and you're asking it to do it with an extremely well-determined waveform. That's the 1 kc note plus the 1.6 kc note. In other words, there's two pure sine waves that you're putting in. Let me drop. Those two sine waves are extremely deterministic. That's a fancy way of saying the exact sum voltage of the two is thoroughly predictable every microsecond of time of the 600 times per second scenario they're going to go through, if you know what I mean. In other words, you're putting in an exact waveform that if the amplifier could follow that exact waveform, the output would be, on the spectrum analyzer, nothing but those two tones. If your amplifier has the slightest amount of top of the screen distortion, or at the bottom it has crossover distortion, or somewhere in between it breaks into oscillation or whatever, if it has anything but that exact deterministic waveform of input sum voltage versus output RF summed voltage, if your system has anything but that exact waveform, your spectrum analyzer will see it. It will show up as these other products called third and fifth order products. Let me drop. And if your amplifier violates this, and if you're using it during a contest, you're probably making splatter, as they say. The guys that are 5KC and 10KC up the band from you in the adjacent field day site are going to be hearing all of those distortion products you're making that are bombing them and desensitizing their receiver when they're trying to hear that DX signal. They're eventually going to find out who you are, and they're going to say some pretty strong things to you, and they're going to say that you're a pretty dirty guy. You ought to clean up your system. So there's all kinds of disadvantages of violating this criteria. The usual ham radio performance requirement is that if at full power output your transmitter will produce these two tones where all undesired products are more than 30 decibels weaker, that's a 1,000-to-1 ratio in power, then most people will say you're running a clean operation. And once you know what you're doing, it doesn't require very elaborate test equipment to do this test. And the most elaborate thing, of course, is the spectrum analyzer. You do have to have a spectrum analyzer most of the time to do this test. And if you can borrow one from somebody, and if there is a spectrum analyzer, so to speak, built into even a service monitor, you can do this test and find out what's the quality of your system and what's the right way to adjust it. As I said, it's an extremely stringent test that immediately shows you exact linearity in a way that would be very difficult to do if you did it 1 dB at a time by stepping power input versus power output. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I think that basically explains everything he needs to know. I don't think there's any other question except if both of those test tone fundamentals were locked where they were in phase, then he would always see that gradual 3 dB reduction. Is that correct?
Now, you said some words that are a little bit ambiguous there, John. If you're putting in two individual tones, 1KC and 1.6KC is my example, two independent signal generators, audio signal generators, yeah, they could be synthesized, and maybe they have a common reference tone of their frequency synthesizer, but the tones themselves do not have to bear any particular relationship. If I was doing this two-tone test, and because one of my audio signal generators has some drift to it, one of them is at 1KC and the other one's at 1.6 kHz, and the 1.6 kHz slowly drifts up to 1.7 kHz, that wouldn't interfere with the quality of the test. On the spectrum analyzer, I would see the two fundamentals slowly drift apart a little bit, and I would see all the products drift apart by the exact same ratio. But that's still a good test. The tones do not have to have any particular phase relationship. Now, if I was putting the two tones through a common voltage summing device, which could be done with resistors, into an adjustable audio attenuator, then by definition, as I adjust that audio attenuator that goes into the microphone circuit of my sideband transmitter, as I adjust it, now both tones are moving up and down by the exact same decibel magnitude, and then you're going to you will follow this 3-to-1 and 5-to-1 ratio. If you only move the amplitude of one of the tones, if the two tones are not equal to each other, you're not really doing a two-tone test anymore, because now you don't have the situation where the two tones, because one's higher in frequency than the other, periodically they're in phase and out of phase, 600 times per second in my example. Let me drop. Because the two tones are no longer exactly equal in amplitude, then when they go out of phase, they do not give you a complete cancellation. Therefore, you're not sweeping up and down the whole dynamic range of the system that you're testing. There is a test you could do where you move just one of the tones in amplitude. That's a very different test than a two-tone test. Sometimes that's done in what's called a three-tone test. I won't tell you why, but there's a whole bunch of reasons on military hardware where you sometimes do a three-tone test. And there you would be adjusting the amplitude of one of the tones compared to the other two. So if you did do that, if you only lowered one of the tones in amplitude of the products that you created, on one side they would move up and down in amplitude faster than the other side. If it was the upper tone that you're moving in amplitude, then I think the upper tones would move faster than the lower tones, the intermodulation distortion products. It's a more complicated test to analyze, therefore most people don't do it that way. They keep the two tones equal in amplitude, but they don't need any particular phase relationship between them, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Quite sufficient. And I think we should move on to the storm analysis now and some of the questions. I'm sure we'll have a few. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, what I intend to do now is to turn the clock back a little bit to what happened for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks of TechNets right after Superstorm Sandy. And we had a lot of discussions on the subject of what's the ideal standby power for my house. And so the super conservative guy, in some cases, will add up every electric appliance in the house, the dryer, the washing machine, the refrigerator, the air conditioner, the electric range, the oven, all the lights, the television. He adds up all of those circuits. He comes up with a number like 18,000 watts, and he goes out and buys an 18,000 watt motor generator set to power his house. Good sounding logic. Those people who did that during Hurricane Superstorm Sandy, my goodness, did they suffer. You would think that they did the super conservative thing. They spent the big bucks, and they used the right kind of a transfer switch. They spent the big bucks for the generator and all the installation, and there's a problem. That 18-kilowatt generator is probably going to burn, let me pick a number, 18 gallons of fuel per day. Where does that fuel come from? That poor guy is standing online with everybody else with a couple of gas cans trying to get fuel to keep that generator running. So the super conservative approach has got a nasty side effect. If you had a great big tank of gasoline on your property, you wouldn't have that problem. But who in the world is going to put a tank of gasoline on his property? The closest thing you've got to that is the 16-gallon tank in your automobile. But trying to suck the fuel out of that automobile nowadays is a very difficult thing to do. They have put anti-siphoning devices in the filler tube of that automobile. Unless you use some very special equipment, you can't get fuel back out of that tank of your automobile. Good job. Now, the other end of the spectrum of what size generator is the one that Dave N2APG chose. I think his is something like a 1.2 kilowatt generator. That thing sips gasoline at the value at the rate of about 1.5 gallons per 24 hours. 1.5 gallons. He only has to go and fill up his gas can once a week. And yes, with 1.2 kilowatts, he can run his house. The first generator I owned was a... let me think now, what brand name was it? I bought it at a local supply house. Can't think of the name of the supply house. Granger. I bought it at Granger. It was a Granger generator. And it was rated, I think it was rated 1,200 watts continuous, 1,500 watts intermittent. And for the first 20 years of me living in this house, whenever I had a power outage, I powered my whole house on a 1,500 watt peak power motor generator set running in the backyard with an extension cord running from it over to the outlet that goes to the outside of the house, and I would backfeed. It's not the recommended technique. I warn you, you're violating some code laws when you do this, when you backfeed. But I did it, and it worked very well. And with 1,500 watts, as long as I play Power Czar, I had creature comfort. I could power the refrigerator, I could power the oil burner, I could power one burner on the electric range, I could power the television sets and lights and whatever, but I had to be the power czar. You couldn't run all those things simultaneously. I ran the refrigerator enough to keep the food from spoiling. Intermittently, I ran the furnace to keep the house reasonably warm. Once in a while, we ran one burner on the stove to cook food if we weren't using the camping equipment. For the repeater, timeout. day we were occasionally running lights and television set, whatever. So as long as you are willing to play power czar and turn things on and off in the right order, and even, by the way, if somebody goofs, if I'm running the oil burner, and maybe I could run the oil burner and the refrigerator simultaneously, as long as they're not both in the exact same startup mode, and somebody turns on something else that exceeds 1,500 watts, somebody turns on a toaster, which adds 1,000 watts to the system, and now we've got 2,000 watts of total drain. That's not the end of the world. The motor generator set looks at the fact that you put on too much of a load, and it simply stalls. You turn off one of those appliances, you go out there and restart the motor generator set. And some of them even have a circuit breaker built in to even give you protection from intermittent, very high power loads that don't stall it, if you know what I mean. So what's the right size of generator is one of your very first questions. As you can see, on either end, there's a bit of a disadvantage. Let me drop it. You choose one too big, and in a situation where Hurricane Sandy has a whole lot of gas stations that are not operating and there isn't any fuel flowing into Long Island, and you're standing on line with everybody else, there's a huge disadvantage of being too big. I don't know of a huge disadvantage of being too small, just that it's a bit inconvenient, and you have to keep track of things. You have to be the power czar in your house. You have to tell the members of your house what they're allowed to turn on when. And who has the power? You've got the power to do the commanding as to how you dole out the power, if you know what I mean. And so you don't have to live in the lap of luxury, for the few hours per year on average that we have a power outage. If you have to live a Spartan existence for those few hours, for many people that's adequate. And so just to make sure that your food doesn't spoil, your house doesn't freeze, and you've got a little bit of creature comfort, light, and television set, that's all you really need during those few hours per year on average. And even if you have an extended outage for multiple days, feeding the gasoline into that thing when it's a small generator, as you can see, has got some huge advantages from my point of view. Now, maybe not everybody thinks the way I do, but that's one of the things to be considered. Let me drop. Another way of looking at a Cadillac system is one that thoroughly automatically operates a transfer switch that when loco goes down for more than 10 seconds, the system senses that. It flips the transfer switch from local power to local power and demands that your generator, which is in its own little doghouse in the backyard, it turns on by way of its battery, and it goes up into a startup operation, and it backfeeds your house. That's another kind of Cadillac system. However, you're going to pay some pretty big bucks for that installation. And so how much are you willing to do as far as the installation, and how much are you willing to do when it comes to controlling it? Are you willing to manually flip a switch? In my particular case, I don't even have a transfer switch. As I said, I am breaking some code rules when I do it. But I take the master circuit breaker on my fuse panel, and I disconnect me from loco, and then I plug in my generator and backfeed the house. And for me, that works, particularly when my later generator happens to be a 220 generator, 220 volt. Therefore, it feeds the whole house. What I used to do with a single 1,500 watt, one-phase, 120 volt generator is that I would then put a jumper clip lead at the fuse panel that took the A side and the B side of my house and connected them together in parallel so that everything in the house was now powered. As I said, it's not a recommended procedure. I'm breaking some rules to do that. I'm taking some risk when I do that. For me, it worked. I'm not telling you to do that. I'm telling you what I did. I know you guys have got a lot more suggestions, questions, and whatever on the subject of standby power because it is predictable. Let me drop it. With the snow that's going to happen in the next couple of days and the high winds and whatever, a predictable number of us are going to lose power in the next few days. And so we're going to be in the situation where, what do you use for standby power? We amateurs have the ability to stack up enough car batteries, so to speak, with inverters that can run our ham radio equipment for extended periods of time. And maybe, in many cases, the most convenient source of power is your automobile. That 12-volt alternator plus the battery in your automobile, boy, that's capable of giving you quite a few. Let me think now. 100 amperes at 100 at 12 volts. That's 1.2 kilowatts. That automobile can supply 1.2 kilowatts to you. And it's in a very convenient location outdoors. It's got a very convenient local supply of gas in that portable gas tank that's inside of that automobile. What really happened during Sandy, let me drop it. I remember asking quite a few people, did you buy the cigarette lighter charger for your cell phone? And a significant number of people would say, what's that? In other words, when it comes, a lot of people, their cell phone ran out of power, they had no way to charge it, because they didn't buy that fairly inexpensive thing where from the cigarette lighter of the car, they can charge their cell phone. And those people were running around like chickens with their heads cut off, looking for a way to charge their cell phone. If they found some guy like a portable electronic news gathering truck for the local broadcast station, sometimes they would let people plug in their cell phones to charge them. And once their cell phone was charged, they found out that their local cell site wasn't on the air because it had standby batteries that are only good for 6 or 8 hours, and they didn't have a standby generator. So even when the cell phone worked, the cell site didn't work, and they still didn't have communication. So there's all kinds of lessons to be learned here. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K6DPZ for the quickie answer, I'm late.
Okay. I think you should give us extensive answers because this is an extensive subject, Hal. But tell us whatever you can because what did you do during Sandy? K6DPZ, the man from Richmond Hill, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, I was very fortunate. We didn't lose electricity. We didn't have any water. So I was very fortunate. You know, everybody else here down south had problems. I didn't have any problems at all. And, you know, that's the way it worked out. Now, being in Oceanside, I don't know if Sandy comes again. Being on, you know, I do have a high ranch, but I tried to protect it. And I'll see what happens in the future. KQRIW, keep six darling purple zombies.
Dick, with a related question. You know, the thing you didn't answer, Hal, is that what are you going to do to make sure you have standby power in Oceanside at your new house? Had you lost power at Richmond Hill, what would you have done? And do you have a suggestion for how people should create uninterruptible power for we ham radio operators? Do you have a recommended suggestion as to how you would like to create uninterruptible power? Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
Over here in Oceanside, I'm planning to get a 5 kW generator, gas generator. And being I have amateur radio equipment in the car, as well as, you know, in the house, I should be able to maintain communications if I have to do it. And I don't think there's going to be another Sandy for a long time to come, Dick. Go ahead.
You're probably right, but I remember people saying right after Hurricane Gloria, and I was involved in an operation where I supplied 500 generators to my fellow workers at Airborne Instruments Laboratory and quite a few of their friends, 500 or was it 600 generators of 4 kilowatts each, and these were multi-fuel generators that would run on liquid propane, natural gas, or gasoline, had an electric starter, 12-volt battery charger, rather fancy Winco brand name, Earth Energy Systems Winco, and as I said, each one of those is like 160 pounds, and 500 of them were two complete tractor-trailer trucks filled to the top just to transport all of that hardware from Wisconsin to Long Island. I think it was Wisconsin where they came from. So that was a pretty big operation I was involved in after Hurricane Gloria. And we all said, hey, this is never going to happen again. And then came Hurricane Irene. And then came Hurricane Sandy. And we say, it ain't going to happen again. But we can say those words. And I hope you're right, but the history doesn't say so. I know you got a further question on all of the above, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Yeah, I'm the one that opened up this whole can of worms with my question. Dick, you know my situation here, being an amputee in the last year. Tell me one what would it cost? Because it's out of the question for me to go pull start a generator. And I'm not doing it now. It's for the future. It's on my wish list. What do you think, round figure, would cost for a moderate-sized generator with an electric start and a transfer switch installed? I believe there are all types of permits. I'm in the town of Oyster Bay. I have no idea what's required here. The other thing, I'm going to reset. I don't know if myself and Patricia should get some help financially. We're both disabled, so maybe we could. I don't know what's available out there in that sense. Back to Ned and to Rio.
VDH with a cost?
VDH, give us your full call and your name and go right ahead with your information, sir.
Yeah, fine business. The call is WA2VDH. Name is John. And I just wanted to give you a cost on a Generac system. We were out 2 weeks with Sandy, and I had a Guardian 8kW Generac generator put in. I guess you would consider it the Cadillac approach, but I don't drive a Cadillac. But anyway, it's rated at 8kW, and it handles pretty much everything in the house. It includes the transfer switch and plumbing, the gas plumbing for it. The whole price, including the permits, which was done by a contractor called Mr. Sparky. They are electrical contractors on the island. The entire price for the permits, gas plumbing, transfer switch, and the whole kit and caboodle was $9,500. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's darn good information, John. I think you said 8 kilowatts, I'm not sure. And so give us a few words now on Generac is a very respected brand name. And we go to that website, you'll see quite a few different sizes of automatic start type generators. In your case, I'm guessing there's a transfer switch, which maybe is manually operated by you, or maybe it's automated. I'm guessing this generator is located outside of your house, because you never want to put a thing like that inside the house. I'm guessing it's in its own doghouse, so to speak. And so, and the electric start, you know, the battery built in that automatically starts it. A lot of the better made generators have that these days. So give us a few more words along these lines, John. W2VDH, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, you're right. It sits in out in the backyard. The permits required it to be at least 5 feet from the house. So there was quite, we had to run a gas line, a standalone gas line from the meter to the back of the house to power the generator. The transfer switch is a 10-line transfer switch. If you want to check it out on the net, if you go to the Generac website, it's one of the Guardian series. The Guardian series, they make three models in that series. There's an 8kW, 17kW, and a 22kW. I have the smallest one. That's the 8kW Guardian series. As I said, it's automatic start. When main power goes out, it starts up. And then after it stabilizes, 10 seconds later, the transfer switch kicks over and takes over everything. Let me drop. The transfer switch then kicks over, and whatever lines you have specified to be hooked up to the transfer switch, they pick up automatically. So on that transfer switch, I have the furnace, the kitchen, the refrigerator, the ham station, of course, and a couple of other things. As I say, I don't think I have ever used 8kW, even under normal conditions, since I've been in the house, even with an air conditioner in the summer. But as I mentioned, one thing I did have to do, though, and it was all included, was that since I have gas heat, I had to swap out my gas meter for a 400 cubic foot per hour gas meter, because under worst case conditions, when the furnace and the water heater and the generators on, the gas flow rate could be up over 300 cubic feet per hour. So I had to have a larger capacity gas meter. Let me drop it. But as I mentioned, the electrical contractor, Mr. Sparky, and you'll see them in the phone book, they took care of all of the gas permits, the electrical permits, and everything. And as I said, the whole price pretty much came to about $9,500. As I said, that included everything with the plumbing, doing the gas piping, the whole permits and everything. Back to net.
Fantastic. That's a lot of good information, John. That's the whole thing, soup to nuts. And in the case of what I think Rich needs, it is my belief that 8 kilowatts is more than enough. And yes, to have natural gas power it, which means that's one of the most reliable fuels on Long Island. It almost never fails. It's always there. You don't have to worry about filling up the gas tank. Unfortunately, I think that Rich does not have natural gas at his house in Massapequa, in which case his generator is going to have to be powered by either gasoline or oil. Oil would be the nicest, except that you're down to a much smaller number of generators that you can select that are powered with oil. Generac does make oil-powered diesel generators, so to speak. But I believe they only come in the larger size. 18 kilowatts and above is my belief. So let me pass it over to Rich. Drag your feet a little, Rich, in case there are other people who want to contribute information to this. N2EO with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, speak common.
Okay, you said it so extremely fast. It sounded like K2LSP. Give me the call letters correctly, slowly. And your name, sir. And then go ahead with your information. K2LSP, question mark. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick and all on the net. This is Russ, Kilo Charlie 2, Lima, Sierra Bravo. Comment on natural gas fired generators and the sustainability of natural gas during emergencies. I live in Breezy Point. You guys have probably heard of that place. The entire natural gas infrastructure in Breezy Point was destroyed, believe it or not, during Hurricane Sandy. Natural gas was not on. They had to replace the entire distribution network from steel pipe to the high-pressure plastic pipe before we had natural gas back. It took quite a long time. Back to net, Casey 2-0.
I'd like to believe, Russ, that that's a rare situation. Yes? Breezy Point had an extremely unusual situation where the water flooding was so severe the fire department couldn't get there. The salt water coming in contact with pole pit transformers and electrified houses created a fire. That fire spread to something like 100 or 150 houses that essentially burned to the ground. So that's an extremely unusual, that's a once per 50 year event. So, maybe you don't know of any other case where gas was interrupted, natural gas flow. But sorry to hear that your house was in Breezy Point. My guess is only a certain percentage of the residents of Breezy Point have had their house restored, had their hopefully friendly insurance company give them what they deserved. Without coming excuses why they didn't deserve it. Give us a few more words on this one, Russ. KC2LSP, Lima Sierra Bravo. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick. What had happened with the fire that you mentioned was that many houses were rocked off their foundation by the storm surge, which created ruptured natural gas lines, sparking from overhead wires and so on, as you mentioned, sparked that fire. Combining the pressurized gas coming out with the high winds and so on, that took out over 100 houses alone. There were many other houses that were completely destroyed by wind and water.
There is quite a large amount of reconstruction going on. There are a lot of those 100 homes have been rebuilt. They were actually, believe it or not, the lucky ones because they didn't have to fight with the insurance companies over was it water damage, was it wind damage. The houses burned, not essentially to the ground. They were gone given the heat of that fire. In any case, insurance companies and whatnot, the city and buildings department, FEMA and so on, there's a lot of angst still going on in terms of trying to get what people deserve and so on. It's an ongoing circumstance that isn't going to resolve anytime soon. But we are coming back. As KC2, I'll be back to NASA.
Well done. Now, to my knowledge, Breezy Point, I think, is, yes, it's in one of the five boroughs of New York City. I'm pretty sure the mayor ordered an evacuation. So a lot of those residences were evacuated. And as bad as the damage was, and I guess very few places had more damage than Breezy Point, if I understand correctly, although some people were injured, I think there were no fatalities in Breezy Point. Am I approximately correct on that one, Russ? KC2LSB, K2LIW?
Yes, Dick. The Breezy Point is at the western end of the Rockaway Peninsula, which extends roughly from the Five Towns area west. Breezy Point being at the western end is kind of south of Brooklyn, but we are part of Queens, and yes, we were exceedingly fortunate that even though a lot of people did stay in violation, so to speak, of the mayor's order to evacuate, we suffered no human fatalities. There were some animals that died in the process, unfortunately, but there were no human fatalities whatsoever here in Breezy Point.
You being a resident would know better than anyone else, Russ. Because the mayor ordered an evacuation and a few people wanted to stay and defend their house, I'd like to believe that was the minority. In other words, of all the residents, I'd like to say that maybe only 5% remained, 95% did evacuate, and that's probably one of the major reasons why there was no fatalities. Are my numbers even closer, Russ? KC2LSB, K2LIW?
You know, Dick, I'm not sure, but there certainly were quite a number of people that did stay. I'm going to say the lion's share of people actually did evacuate. I think part of the problem is that you have people down here that have been here for so long. They've seen so many storms come and go. With Irene the year before, you know, the bad storm just before it, a year before, I think people are saying, oh, it's probably not even going to be as bad as Irene and so on. You know, they were wrong. Unfortunately, and you know, there's no way to predict it. One of the things that I took away from the whole event was that basically, when you're told to evacuate, you do, because the only thing that you can affect by not doing that is the manner and timing of your own death. So that's my philosophy at this point. If you tell you to get out, get out. Back to net.
It sounds to me, Russ, like you did evacuate. And when you were allowed to come back to your community, my guess is that first view was quite shocking. Am I true? Am I anywhere? Is that approximately what happened, Russ? Go ahead.
Well, actually, no. what happened was I packed my wife and one of my sons off to Bayside up on the ridge. And my other son and I stayed to defend the house. We fortunately, my house did not suffer terribly in the storm. We had a full basement full of water. It was a little bit, you know, sketchy, you know, butterflies in the stomach, so to speak, as you're watching the water come up your cellar steps. The next morning, after we waited out the next high tide cycle to make sure everything was, you know, going to be okay, we wandered out and, you know, first thing was to look at my house, and again, it was structurally sound. But the devastation all around me was absolutely phenomenal. It cannot be described, even with pictures. You had to be there to hear the sounds, to see the sights, to smell the smells. It was a real shocking thing to walk through.
And where you're describing salt water in your basement coming up the stairs, I'd like to believe that either your power was off at that instant, but you absolutely did not go into that salt water. As you probably know, I'm trying to spread the word that when salt water pours into your basement and You've got your valuable photographs, you've got your valuable computers, you've got your valuable records and whatever in that basement. Do not go into that salt water to recover your valuables. You're putting yourself at a huge electrocution risk.